Good day, Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast listeners. What a fun show we have for you this week. I was off in the corner of the barn cleaning things up and sweeping.
It's an Augean task.
But I got to overhear this week's show, and it was pretty terrific.
Special guest host, none other than my daughter, Catherine Jenkinson.
You know, it's great to be here, Dad and David, although I'm just sorry to see the state that the barn is in today.
Ouch!
Really just...
What's wrong with the barn?
It's a little dirty, it's a little cold.
It's a barn!
You raise your children, you send them off for special Ivy League education,
and they come back and condemn you. All kidding aside, it's just wonderful to have you here, Catherine. You know, we get so many pieces of fan mail about, when's she coming back again?
Oh, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm thrilled to be allowed to come back. Thank you for having me.
And you are not a barn denier. You know, lots of people say, oh, no barn.
I would never. I would never deny something as concrete as the barn.
Well, it's not really concrete.
Well, you know.
You know, there's straw.
A shack.
There's hay.
But let's talk about what's coming up on the show. It's a great show. It's perfectly timed. It's Thanksgiving. And you guys, you spend the hour talking to President Jefferson about food.
Absolutely. This is something that we've been talking about a lot because my dad really comes from the attitude that food is food to a certain degree, and Jefferson seems to just be so different from that.
There's no bus she won't throw me under.
No.
I do believe that food is food.
I don't think that's a bad thing.
Food is love.
Oh, my. You sound like an old Beatles song.
No,
here, David.
It's just, you know, you feed your children because you love them.
Do you know that the Latin word company means breaking bread together?
I did not.
Isn't that something?
What's the original word, do you know?
Pania is bread, and calm is together. So break bread together is to be together over bread is what company means. I think that's lovely. I do think that Thanksgiving is far and away my favorite holiday. Oh, by far. I think it's the only great American holiday. It's the least destroyed by capitalism of all of our holidays. It's the sacrament of abundance. Families pray together that don't pray otherwise. They hold hands and say what they're thankful for. For me, it's a perfect holiday.
It is good, and I would agree with you. But I must say, it's wonderful to have Catherine back.
She's out cleaning the barn, and she's left us to finish this podcast introduction.
You know, as always, she has no fear of you Jefferson.
That's to put it lightly. She's a little bit snotty, I think.
I did take a little exception with her about nobody ever challenging Mr. Jefferson.
What did she call you? A toady or unctuous?
I think it was a sycophant.
A sycophant. I don't think she meant you.
I don't know.
But she specializes in challenging Mr. Jefferson.
Anyway, she's great.
And at the end of the first segment, she throws Sally Hemings' children in Mr. Jefferson's face. You know what happens when you do that.
Yeah, he'd have walked out on me, but he didn't dare do it when it was a matter.
Let's let them listen and decide for themselves. This is my daughter, Miss Catherine Jenkinson, age 23, now a graduate of St. Andrews University, back between life assignments, living with the old man, forcing him to eat these packaged food things and so on. And she is the host of this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the humanities scholar, author, and creator of the Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. I'm your guest host, Catherine Jenkinson. I'm so happy to be here back at the barn. Good day to you, Mr. President.
Good day to you, madam.
Mr. President, today I'd like to talk to you about food. Food was such an enormous part of your private and public life, and I'm very interested to hear, and I think our listeners are interested to hear, the extent of your love for food and where that began. So let's start very basically. Did your love of food start before or during your time in France?
Oh, much before. So, as you know, food is one of the fundamentals of life. We need to breathe oxygen, we need water, and we need food, and so everyone has food, and it doesn't much matter in a certain sense what food we have as long as it holds the engine of our body and soul together. But in Virginia, food always means something very special. Virginia was a place of great abundance. It was the largest of the colonies and the largest of the states of the original United States. It was the most fertile. It had the largest population. And so Virginia was almost a symbol of the abundance of America. And I lived in the part of Virginia, I think, that had the most healthy climate. And the gardens and fields at Monticello were extremely productive. And it was a settled habit of Virginians to be hospitable. This was a time when there were very few inns and almost no public restaurants. And so private plantation owners or farmers provided hospitality to virtually anyone who turned up, and we Virginians were famous for the abundance that we offered to ourselves and to everyone else. So I was interested in food from an early period in my life, but the food of Virginia is abundant and healthful and good, but we had not really developed cuisine in Virginia, just as our wines in America, port and sherry and Madeira and so on, brandy, were adequate but not special, not very fine, in fact, in their quality. And so when I went from Monticello to Williamsburg to be a university student, I had better food than I had ever had at home. When I went for the first time up to Annapolis and New York, the food was better there than it was in Virginia. And of course, when I went to France in 1784, first to be the American minister there and eventually the American ambassador, I discovered a quality in food that I had frankly never experienced before. And I became so fascinated by the excellence of French cookery that I decided to incorporate many of the recipes and much of the style of French cuisine into my own life, and it turns out the life of the United States when I returned in 1789.
But could you describe exactly how French cuisine was different from the typical Virginian fare? You say that the quality was much higher, but in what sense did it differ?
Quantities were smaller, sauces were more subtle and exquisite. There was an art to the display, to what you would call the plating of food. The French regard everything as an art form, music and dance and architecture and gardening and conversation and indeed food. And although the French diet had been born from a time when there was no adequate means of preserving food, so their sauces had been developed to cover whatever was wanting in the quality of the protein, those sauces were the greatest in the world, and they changed food from provender into something like an art form. And when I saw that food could be not just a way of meeting the dietary needs of the body, but a way of lifting life to a higher plane of dignity and mastery and even art, I wanted, in an American way, to incorporate some of that into my own life. And so it was in Virginia, there would be abundance of food, but not great elegance in its presentation and not great elegance in the taste. It was a very basic set of tastes, you might say an American set of tastes. And in France, all of the mastery was focused on what was unique, what was unusual, what had a subtle aftertaste, what awakened the palate in certain ways. And I think it's even fair to say that the French had intuited certain things about the way taste works. I mean, literally, the way the taste buds respond to sweet and sour and pungent and bland, that was to enliven one's sensibility and make the kind of conversations that occurred at table to be exquisite because of the basis in the food supply.
This sort of education of your palate seems very extensive, but were there things from your childhood and life in Virginia that you missed? You seem to have requested hams and cranberries to be shipped to you in France. Were there other sort of things that the quality could not compete in France with what a Virginia farm could produce?
Yes, we had the most fertile climate in the world. You know, almost everything is more abundant and the stature larger for American animals compared to their counterparts in Europe. And there are certainly things you just couldn't get in Europe at this time. So you couldn't get cranberries, which are a New England commodity. And there's nothing as good as a Virginia ham anywhere in the world. And so we were specialists in this sort of thing. And I miss those. I miss turkeys. Turkeys are an American bird that is that Ben Franklin wanted to be the national bird of the United States because it's uniquely American. And so, of course, one misses those things when you're abroad, and when you miss them, they seem more important than they are. When you get back and you've had them, then you realize that you've exaggerated their quality somewhat. So I had those things that I could get shipped to France, sent there. But more than that, I wanted to bring what I learned from France back to the United States. So here's what I did. As you probably know, when I went there in 1784, I took my daughter Martha with me, and I took one slave. His name was James Hemings. He was one of the famous Hemings family at Monticello. He was an unusually intelligent young man, and I carried him with me to France to serve as my private manservant. He was willing to go, and when we got there, I farmed him out to French families so that he could learn to speak French fluently. And then it came to me, because of his own natural skills, that he might make a great chef, a great cook. And so I actually arranged for him to be formally apprenticed to learn French cookery, and he did. We were there for 5 full years, and within a short time he knew French better than I did, certainly oral French better than I did. He traveled more widely in Paris circles than I ever could because, of course, I had extensive diplomatic duties that I had to undertake. And he then did apprentice with French cooks and mastered a great deal of French cuisine, and then was able to bring that skill back with him to the United States and to Monticello in November of 1789. So he came with me. As you probably know, his younger sister, Sally Hemings, came later. She came as the chaperone to my daughter, Maria. And so when she arrived in France, she and her brother were reunited in Paris.
How did you convince him to stay with you in France, though, Mr. President? As I'm sure you know, James Hemings may have been a slave in the United States, but he was a free man in France.
Yes, it was illegal in France to own slaves, and I could not control his activities. You know, I either had to send him back to the United States, or I had to keep him very closely quartered in my own salons, my own diplomatic household. But since I wanted him to learn the art of French cookery, and it had emplaced him in the city of Paris, one of the world's great cities, certainly the most culturally advanced city in the world of the time, he soon mastered French, and I had no way of knowing exactly what his conversations were, but he soon learned that under French law, slavery was illegal, which it should be everywhere, of course. And so he came to me. In fact, he and his sister came to me, he and Sally Hemings. He did the talking. She was, of course, much more demure. And he said, "Mr. Jefferson," you know, very politely. I mean, he was always a very polite man. He said, "Mr. Jefferson, you are aware, I'm sure, that under French law, slavery is illegal, and therefore there is no legal way in which you can bind my sister and me to you. If we chose to stay here in Paris, we could. We would be protected under French law. I have work. I would be able to support myself and my sister here. Tell me why, sir, we would go back to the United States with you. Why should we agree to return to the degradation of American slavery when we are free for the first time and potentially forever here in Paris?" And when he put this to me, I knew it was true. I had advised other Americans who brought slaves into France of how to handle this somewhat delicate situation. And so I said to him, "You are correct. If you two decide you want to stay in Paris, there's nothing I can do about it. I will not force you in any way, not that I even could force you to come back with me. But I made a different agreement with each of them, brother and sister. I said to James Hemings, 'I've invested a considerable amount in your apprenticeship, and you now have a set of skills that I really want back in Virginia and at Monticello. So if you will agree to return with me, when I go back, and then train somebody else in the Monticello community in French cookery. At that point, I'll free you, and I'll give you some startup money to go to the city of your choice, Philadelphia or wherever it might be, and I will formally manumit you. But you, the condition of that is that you return with me, you trust that I will not betray this agreement, and that you teach somebody else the art of French cuisine. And to Sally Hemings, I said, if you return, then I will agree to free all of any children that you might have. If you have any children at all, when they reach adulthood, when they're 21 years old, I will find a way to manumit them. And of course I did. So they did come back with me because they trusted this bargain. And he did, in fact, teach somebody else the art of French cookery. And as you know, she eventually had a number of children, all of whom were freed either during my lifetime or at the time of my death in 1826.
And many of whom were your own sons, Mr. President. We need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. This week, we are speaking with President Jefferson about food. Mr. Jefferson, before the break, I accused you of freeing some of your own sons, the children of Sally Hemings. I really should have said sons and daughters. There are four known children of Sally Hemings. Would you care to comment on this, Mr. President?
No, madam, I would not. I blush for you.
Fair enough. Well, we were talking about James Hemings. Whatever happened to him after he left your service?
He did come back, according to the agreement that we made in France. He did pass on his knowledge. In fact, he wrote out some recipes in a recipe book, and I then copied some of that in my own hand. Those documents still exist. And then I freed him, as I had promised to do, and gave him $50, which was a considerable amount of money at the time. And then he left, and I did not follow this very closely, but I know he went to Philadelphia and began work as a cook. And I know he returned to France, which is an extraordinary thing for a free black man to have done at that time. I'm sorry to say that the word came to me at Monticello that he died as a young man at the age of 36 and that he died by his own hand. Now, just why he committed suicide, I don't know, but I was, of course, saddened to learn that this was his fate, but I did follow through with my agreement to manumit him, and I gave him enough money to start up a life in a northern city where race was not as significant an issue as it was in Virginia.
Well, you may not be aware of this, Mr. Jefferson, but in recent years, James Hemings has come to prominence as the first African-American chef of the United States and a very important figure in early modern American cuisine. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm pleased for that, of course. I always wanted to see proofs of black capacity. You know, there were many people who thought that blacks were natural slaves, that they were at some lower stage of their development than their white counterparts, and I even flirted with that idea myself in my only book, Notes on the State of Virginia. I said I advanced it as a suspicion only that this might be true, but I said I was always looking for proofs of black capacity and black achievement. And many of the slaves at Monticello, the enslaved people, were artisans. A relatively large percentage of them were literate. Some of the best artwork that was done at Monticello in carpentry and in The woodworking of the house was done by skilled black artisans. And so it's not at all surprising. The Hemmings family were a particularly able family. They had had a special status not only at Monticello, but previously at my father-in-law's plantation, The Forest, down near Williamsburg. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that this would be the case. And most of the cooks, in fact, at Monticello, not chefs, but most of the cooks were black. They were usually black women. And so it doesn't seem particularly striking to me that this should have happened, but I'm pleased that I was able to play a small role in the achievement of James Hemmings. And I would not have had to send him out to become an apprentice in French circles of cookery, but I did because I selfishly wanted to have some of those recipes for myself, and I wasn't the sort of person who was going to learn to cook in the French manner alone. So, I would not have been aware of his historic status in the way that you say, but I'm not at all surprised.
In addition to James Hemmings and other slaves who prepared meals for you, you also imported two French chefs, first Petit, and then later in the White House, a man named Lemaire. Could you speak a little bit about that and what it means to have a French chef in an American White House and any sort of criticism you might have faced for that?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't feel at all apologetic about this. When you have eaten the best food in the world, as French food certainly is, in my opinion, you don't want to go back to hams and yams and turkeys and American sweetmeats. And so when I came back, I did invite these superb French gentlemen, these skilled artisans to come. And they served me through the course of my presidency and beyond. And, people might have been willing to criticize this until they ate their food. But once you've had the food that these men were able to produce and the wines that they were able to serve and the style at table, I mean, literally everyone in Washington, D.C. wanted invitations to my White House dinners. A couple of afternoons per week, two or sometimes three, I would have 10 or 12 people over. I chose those guests very carefully so that they would harmonize. I didn't want any political rancor or tension or disputation at my table. And so I would go through all the roles of Congress and the diplomatic establishment and my cabinet ministers and visiting scientists and scholars and men of letters and administration officers. And I would then carefully choose the 10 or 12 people I wanted on this Tuesday or that Thursday. I did this all of the time of my 8 years as president and was regarded as the most successful master of hospitality in the United States at the time. And then I chose the wines, and I often served 2, 3, 5, even sometimes 7 wines at one of these meals. I chose the menu. I worked with these Frenchmen to determine what the menus would be, and I like to surprise people. I like people to be eating along at their meal and then suddenly surprised by a taste that they had never had before or a visual display of food that they had never seen before. And so I played a very, what you'd call, hands-on role in all of this and would negotiate with these chefs to determine what we would serve at the White House. And it was always done with an eye to pleasing, of course, hospitality, partly with an eye to surprising, to delight my visitors, because where there is delight, there is greater harmony, and also to experiment. And the only person who ever really criticized me in any overt way about this was Patrick Henry. Not at all surprising. Patrick Henry is a demagogue, and he's the kind of man who can tear down the British colonial empire but has no idea how to build up something in its place. And so when I came back to the United States and began to favor French wines and French cookery, Henry famously said, "Mr. Jefferson has abjured his native victuals." That I had betrayed the eating habits and the eating style of my upbringing, and I had become Frenchified in my manners. And he said he abjured his native victuals as a way of suggesting that I had ceased to be a good American.
Very well, Mr. President, but I'm inclined to agree with Patrick Henry to some extent on this. You fell in love with creme brulee and ice cream, macaroni and cheese.
Are you criticizing these, madam?
This isn't exactly the abstemious diet so famously attributed to Julius Caesar, is it?
But you're not criticizing such things as macaroni or creme brulee, are you?
I would never criticize those foods, Mr. President, but I am forced to ask you, are you in fact a food snob, as we would say in 2017?
Certainly not, madam, and I think if you came to one of my dinners at the White House or at Monticello, you would probably be more generous in your view. It wasn't designed to show off. It was designed to please. And so if the British had had a better cuisine than the French, I would have chosen that. If the people of northern Italy had a superior diet, I would have chosen that. Or for that matter, if the people of Ohio or Vermont had a superior dietary system, I would have wanted to move in that direction, to health, plenty, delight, subtlety. But the fact is that, just as I said, every man's first country is his own and every rational man's second country must be France. So, too, of course, we have a prejudice in favor of the food of our childhood, but every rational person prefers French cuisine to any other in the world, madam. And I think if you had come to these dinners at the White House, you would not be wondering whether I was a food snob. You would be saying, more, please, more, sir.
And I think, Mr. President, if you were a citizen of 21st century America, you would hesitate before saying foods like baked Alaska were emblems of subtlety and health.
Well, the baked Alaska was really quite extraordinary because you have to remember that we lived in an age before refrigeration. So in your time, with freezers and refrigeration, this would not be so remarkable. But imagine if you come to the White House. Let's say you're a grumpy person like John Quincy Adams, a senator from Massachusetts, who disliked me. He disliked me for a whole range of reasons, but mostly because he felt that I was unfair to his father. So he comes to the White House. He kept an extensive diary. You can look up his diary entries yourself. He comes to the White House, and we have this beautiful meal, and he's enjoying the wines and enduring the conversation. And then suddenly the servants bring out this pastry, and it is a hot, even steaming puff pastry. And he thinks, oh, it's an interesting sort of thing. And then he puts his fork in it, and there's a ball of ice cream in the center of it. So think of that. How can you have a ball of ice cream at the center of a pastry that just came directly out of a hot oven? That would be regarded as a food miracle in my time, not so much in yours. But just think of the delight people had when they came to my White House, not knowing what was going to happen, but knowing something remarkable was likely to happen. And then seeing such a contrast as what you call baked Alaska must have been to them. So even people as professionally curmudgeonly as John Quincy Adams came away pleased with this cuisine.
But you didn't only bring baked Alaska and its variants to the White House, Mr. President. Would you dispel some myths about other foods you brought to America? You've long been lauded as the man who brought macaroni and cheese, and indeed it does seem that you sent William Short to Naples to get you a macaroni mold. But what else did you bring? Is it true that you imported French fries and champagne, Parmesan cheese, waffles, etc. to the United States?
Well, some of all of that is true. Let me go through them, and you'll remind me if I forget. So ice cream, yes and no. I was one of the first Americans to have an ice cream recipe, to have an ice cream maker. You'll see in any cookbook from Monticello, my particular recipe for ice cream, it's something that I thought was an extraordinary dessert, and I was able to produce it, and I served it in a range of forms. But I'm not the only one. I think George Washington played a role in this. It's not as if I introduced ice cream to a world that had never seen it before. As to the macaroni question, you know, pasta was relatively new in my time. It doesn't go back to the Roman Empire or to Julius Caesar. Pasta was a relatively modern invention. It was called paste. The word pasta means paste, and so the first British observers of it said there's this strange elongated paste that the Italians use. And so once I'd had pasta, I wanted to to be able to produce it at Monticello, and I knew that there were noodle makers, there were macaroni machines, and I did ask my adoptive son, my protege, William Short, to obtain one for me, and he did. But I doubt that this was the first pasta ever served in the United States, and certainly the charge often offered that I introduce macaroni and cheese is something of a myth. As to champagne, I serve champagne, but champagne is a region and a drink. I like the wines, the white wines of champagne, but I didn't like champagne as a sparkling wine, you know, what you have at ceremonial occasions. I thought that was a gimmick. That was a marketing gimmick, and I didn't think that it would last, and I didn't particularly enjoy it. But I did serve white still, what I called the still wines of champagne, amongst others, Burgundies and Bordeaux's and so on. So that part of it is true, but in terms of the popping cork of a champagne bottle, as you understand it, that wasn't something that I thought was a very interesting form of French wine. I had a waffle maker, but there were plenty of people who had come from the Netherlands before me, and I'm certain that I didn't produce the first waffle irons in the United States.
Well, whatever else is true, isn't it correct that you became a sort of culinary figure across colonial America and in the early years of the United States and served as a curator of sorts of French imported goods and did this for George Washington and others?
Well, once I had seen all these things, I wanted to incorporate them. So, for example, I wanted to bring the olive tree to the United States because the olive is such an extraordinary tree. It provides shade. It has a rootedness in the soil, but it also supplies olives, which produce both oil and a nutritional food. And so I brought back cuttings of olive trees, and I tried to get them adopted by agricultural societies in the Carolinas, not with great success. I also smuggled a form of upland rice out of northern Italy because I didn't want us to produce swamp rice. That's not very healthful, but an upland grain of rice, much superior. It was illegal to remove any quantity of that. I did smuggle some out and tried to get agricultural societies to adopt it. I brought Merino sheep to the United States because they were more healthful and they produced a better wool, I thought, and better food than the other sheep that we were using, and so on and so forth. I brought vines, many, many cuttings of French vinifera, and grafted those onto Native American rootstock and so on. I was a sort of a one-man agricultural society, and I was always attempting to improve the diet of the United States and to improve the wealth of the United States. You know, there's no poverty where there's an olive tree. Olives provide a form of almost free nutrition in any place that will grow those olives. And so I did all of this because I was fascinated by it, and I did it because I wanted to ameliorate the condition of mankind, and I did it because I wanted America to have the best of everything that was available in the world. And I then experimented with many of these things in the recipes at Monticello and the recipes in the White House. But I wouldn't want to make too much of this. Where I did have a relatively significant influence was on wine. When I was in France, I learned what wine can be. It certainly is infinitely superior to port and sherry and Madeira and so on. And once you've had true wine, you never want to go back to those fortified alcoholic wines of the British Empire. The problem was, how do you get true wine to the United States? Because wine does not travel very well. It's highly delicate. And so I worked out protocols of how it would be packed and what kinds of ships and what kinds of weather and so on, so that the wines would not be too heavily jostled in their transport. And then, because I was able to work this out, I really, in some sense, invented the transatlantic wine trade of true wines because of my attention to detail. Once I had worked this out, I became known as the great wine connoisseur of the United States. That's something of an exaggeration, but that's what people thought. And so the other four of the first five presidents, George Washington, John Adams, James Madison, James Monroe, all of them felt that I was a superior wine connoisseur, and they all then leaned on me to provide tips or even do their ordering for them. And Washington, famously, you know, the greatest American, but not an expert in wine, turned to me and said, "Mr. Jefferson, you know so much more about this than I do. Would you be willing to give me advice about, would you order wines for me?" And I did. I was very, very happy to serve in this role for for others. And even though I would not make any special claims for myself as the wine connoisseur of the country, I certainly knew more about it than all of those four and was quite happy to do their ordering for them.
Very interesting, Mr. President. And what role did you play inside of the kitchen? You are describing your intense involvement in the selection of foods and in the selection of wines, but would a visitor to Monticello actually find you in an apron beating eggs?
Never. No, never. I know I probably never cooked in the whole course of my life, but I would supervise. And when my wife was alive, she handled that. When I was at Monticello, my daughter Martha, after the death of my wife, handled most of that. I would have maybe talked to the chef or talked to the cooks, and they would have asked me what sort of food I wanted to serve. I might have tasted, they might have called me down or brought me up a meringue to taste or a new sauce to taste, but it was more of a supervisory role. I was never in a kitchen with my sleeves rolled up whipping eggs or frying an egg, for that matter. That would not be regarded as gentleman's work. It wouldn't be regarded as gentlewomen's work either. This was the work done by servants, or in the case of Monticello, by household slaves.
Thank you, Mr. President. We need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. When we return, we'll be speaking with the creator of the Jefferson Hour, Clay Jenkinson. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. This is Clay Jenkinson, a.k.a. the third president of the United States. And sitting across from me here in the New Enlightenment Radio Network barn is none other than my beloved daughter, Catherine Missouri Walker Jenkinson. Catherine, welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, although I have to say it's not great to be here on a day where it's snowing so profusely and it's less than 30 degrees in North Dakota at the barn.
But the barn is warm inside. Now, I have to say, I mean, first of all, you have a following. People, when you have been host before, people have written in. They really like the program you did on Jefferson and women. There's a little, how shall I put it, a little irreverence in your tone. Is this natural to you, or do you do it merely with Mr. Jefferson?
Oh, no, I would never presume to be critical of anyone except for Mr. Jefferson. But, you know, I hear the program, and I hear these sycophants just listening to everything Mr. Jefferson says, and no
one
ever challenges him.
So you did. The guest always chooses the topic. You chose Jefferson and food. Why?
Well, it is the middle of the harvest season, and Thanksgiving quickly approaches. And this is a question we've been talking about what menu should be, and is food simply food, or should food be grand and delightful and surprising?
Now, when you did your research on this, first of all, we should dispel some myths. So, you know, it's often thought Jefferson brought ice cream to this country. Not so.
Not necessarily true, but it is the case that there are handwritten recipes in Mr. Jefferson's hands of ice cream and other sorts of things like French fries, except French fries in rounds rather than in the spears that we see them in the 21st century.
And you and I have actually made Jefferson's ice cream recipe together. Also, the waffle and macaroni, what do you know about this?
Sure. Parmesan cheese, we know that Jefferson brought to the United States and even had imported, and on a trip to Italy, went to go see how Parmesan is made.
And wrote detailed notes about the making of Parmesan, yeah.
Yes, hoping to recreate these things. He brought back with him olive oil, it seems, but this was not possible to grow in the lands of Virginia, so he attempted to make substitutes with sesame oil and other sorts of seeds.
So would you call him a foodie?
Well, I see you rolling your eyes as you say the word foodie. It does seem
Remember,
a little
this is
bit
radio.
Of a millennial sort of term. I'm not sure, but I would call him a food snob.
A food snob. And you, I mean, you said, you asked Mr. Jefferson if obsession with French cuisine was a political issue, and it was for Patrick Henry. Do you, when you hear about this, I mean, these dinners at the White House with seven wines and with all these extraordinary innovations, do you think that's a good thing that Jefferson did, or do you think it's a little much?
Well, I'm not sure exactly how to feel about it, except to say that the cost is enormous to a fairly working class people during Jefferson's time.
And so, to Jefferson himself, as you know, he went into debt doing this.
Of course, but these dinners seem to have been so grand and over the top, and he was criticized not only by people like Patrick Henry, but by John Adams and others, including Dolly Madison, for constantly dining with over a dozen people and taking into very little account the cost of what this might.
Well, it did come out of his own salary. He wasn't charging the people of the United States for this. Jefferson was paid $25,000 per year, which is a gigantic sum. All of his hospitality, all of the wine, all of the French cuisine, all his chefs, all of that was paid for by Jefferson as a citizen. You don't see that today.
No, certainly not. But it is very interesting to see the attention that the President of the United States paid to these menus. And I wonder how much time did the President have that he could be devoting parts of his day to deciding what should be for dinner.
Well, as you know, Catherine, the work of a president is to persuade, is to get people to do what he wants them to do. And Jefferson realized that he could win a lot of support by really laying on magnificent food and wine for the people of Washington, D.C., where there were almost no restaurants and no wine shops or anything else. And so getting an invitation to Jefferson's White House was not just a chance to be with the President of the United States, but it was a chance to have the best meal you probably ever ate.
Sure, but these meals at the same time reflect Jefferson's constant interest in food markets, and he even was recording what the Washington vegetable market was going for in terms of prices during his presidency. So this is clearly a man who cares a lot about food, whether or not he's actually preparing it himself.
Do you think that his food would please us today if we were invited to Jefferson's table? Do you think that the quality of food would hold up over time?
Oh, sure. But I think we might be surprised at the amount of vegetables at Jefferson's table, as, of course, you know, he ate meat only as a condiment and preferred salads and peas and other sorts of vegetables. And presumably the food would have been much fresher because of necessity.
Let's talk a little bit about our own food habits. I'm sure people want to know more about you. I'll ask you what you've been doing with your education here in a minute. But last night, which was a fall night in North Dakota, I processed the last of my tomato crop this year and made tomato juice out of the tomatoes that had frozen and were bruised or whatever, and then used the canning process that didn't exist in Jefferson's time. My garden was a relatively weak one this year. And you have introduced me to this weird new phenomenon of the food packet, the food box. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, this is something new for me too, but as I'm sure most of your listeners know, this sort of fad of meal delivery kits in which fresh ingredients come to your door every Wednesday or Thursday and provide enough for three meals and very detailed recipe cards. So far, we've done it twice with several different companies, and it's not clear that this is cost-effective or the most fresh way to eat food, but it certainly is interesting that on my computer on a Friday, I can order food that will be at our doorstep on a Wednesday.
And it comes in dry ice.
Insulated boxes.
When you open it up, then everything you need except salt and pepper and olive oil is there.
Sure.
And with a highly graphic recipe card. And what does it take, 20 or 30 minutes to prepare the meal? Do you think, in terms of, we've only done two, and I think there are maybe a dozen of these companies now operating. Do you think that, aside from the cost, do you think it's worth it? Do you think the food is good?
I'm not sure. I think the food is okay. It certainly has had me trying things that I would never have made for myself simply out of laziness or being unaware of such recipes, but I'm not sure exactly what the carbon footprint of something like this is. You know, they say every time you eat a serving of meat, that's the equivalent of driving 60 miles in a car. So,
and the dry ice and the shipping.
The dry ice, and although we're not wasting any food because only enough for two servings of three different meals comes every week, I wonder what this footprint is on the earth.
Do you think you're learning anything about the art of cooking from this process?
I'm not sure. It's not exactly teaching us how to blanch potatoes, but it is saying, chop up these chives. It's been interesting, I think.
Well, we'll keep at it, and we'll make some notes on it. But let me ask you a question that I know our listeners will be interested in. You know, you were on this program, I think, 2 years ago now. What have you been doing? What's been going on in your world?
Well, I've just returned to the United States from living in Scotland, where I was in graduate school.
That food capital of the world, Scotland.
Yes. I'm grateful to be back in the United States, but also very grateful for a truly wonderful experience abroad.
So you got an M.Lit., a master's degree in early modern history. Tell us what your actual focus was.
I was studying European history from the early Renaissance to around the time of the French Revolution, just after Jefferson himself was in France. But my particular interest is in British intellectual history of the 16th and 17th centuries, and particularly the history of explorers and their interests in the classical world. I worked on a dissertation about Walter Raleigh's History of the World, which he wrote while imprisoned in the Tower of London.
This immense book he wrote while a state prisoner.
Yes, and he was allowed a library of more than 400 volumes, an enormous library for any person of the day,
let alone in
a prison.
He was on death row in the Tower, and he has this huge library and writes one of the most important books of the Renaissance.
And he's not only writing, but he's conducting alchemical experiments with Henry Percy, the 9th Earl of Northumberland, and other prisoners. And he's being consulted by the Queen, who's asking him for alchemical potions to save their son, Prince Henry.
King James's wife, the Queen.
Right. And seems to have been able to create a thriving intellectual culture within the walls of a prison.
And speaking of high cuisine, you ate haggis on a number of occasions. Tell us what haggis is.
You know, I don't like your attitude about haggis, Dad. I think haggis is actually very good as long as you don't think about it.
You've had haggis.
Of course. I mean, if you go to Scotland and you don't have haggis, why did you even go to Scotland?
It's a sheep gut, a stomach, a sausage of some sort with but minced heart and
it's just
lung
every part of the lamb that you don't want to ever think about or eat. And but when prepared well, it's great.
You liked it.
I thought it was good. I'm not making it for Thanksgiving this year, but I did enjoy it very much. But even more than that, I love a Scotch egg, a sort of
what's that?
Soft-boiled egg or poached egg of some sort wrapped in pork sausage and fried. It's absolutely fabulous.
You put a kind of a crumb thing on it. So it's an egg within a pork meatball within a breaded
yes,
surface.
Absolutely.
And you like the Scotch egg?
Yes, it's fabulous.
And
in
then
every way.
And to drink in Scotland, you like the ciders?
Oh, sure, a Thistle Cross cider or something like that. I wasn't drinking sherry like you are in England.
Wow, really? You're going to make that little attack on Oxford? You were at St. Andrews, which is what, the oldest institution in Scotland?
The oldest institution in Scotland, third oldest in the English-speaking world.
Thank you, Catherine, for taking the time to be on the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Thank you. It's been wonderful to be here, and we'd just like to wish a happy Thanksgiving to all of our listeners. We wish you a wonderful holiday, and now it's time for the Jefferson Watch.
Thank you, Catherine. Thanks for hosting this program, and I will look forward to many more occasions when you grace us with your irreverence towards me or Mr. Jefferson or both. Nobody can quite tell which. Here's this week's Jefferson Watch. The word foodie grates on my nerves a bit. We cannot live without food, water, and oxygen, but somehow it always seems to me misguided to give too much attention to something as basic as provender. On Maslow's hierarchy, food ranks pretty high as a basic necessity, but in the hierarchy of the soul's work, it ranks, for me at least, far down the list of desirabilities. It was Erasmus, the greatest of the humanists, who said, "When I have a little money, I buy books, and if I have any left, I buy food and clothes." That seems right to me, within limits. I'm not quite with Diogenes the Cynic from ancient Athens, who said, eat only to banish hunger, sleep only to banish fatigue, but I am closer to that than I am ever likely to gush over a mango reduction on a fresh catch of mahi-mahi served on a bed of saffron. For me, food's food, more or less. I'm an agrarian, like my hero Jefferson, and I believe the old Farmers Union bumper sticker that said farming is everyone's bread and butter. I have an extensive garden every year. I'm never happier than when I eat an August meal straight out of my garden, a cob of corn snapped off the stalk, a ripe tomato, a cucumber, an onion. That simple meal of things I actually grew with my own hands tastes better to me than the best entree at the highest-rated bistro in Greenwich Village. I admire the farm-to-table movement, and I think questions of food security and the quality of our food are extremely important. Almost every other first-world country is more thoughtful about what we put into our mouths than America, and more watchful of the chemicals that are used to make food production possible. There is not much that is truly agrarian about the American way of eating, and certainly not much that is wholesome. When I go to Greece, I order a Greek salad, cucumber, tomato, green pepper, and feta, at every meal, and I marvel that we make such a fuss about food back home in opulent, overstuffed America. In Rome, as often as not, I order a wee basket of bread, always better than what is available here, a small plate of some kind of pasta, often olio et olio, garlic and olive oil, and a glass of house red wine. Sitting in an olive garden in Maple Grove, Minnesota, that would be an insult. But sitting in the square before the Pantheon, or overlooking the Bay of Naples, it is essentially paradise on earth. Remember, Jefferson said that it is most sensible to order house wine, vin ordinaire, unless you really know what you're doing or are trying to seduce Maria Causeway. In the end, food is just fuel. It keeps the engine running, and for me the engine was designed to do the work of the soul, to read books and maybe write some too, to imagine the world you want to live in, to evaluate the events that take place in the public square, to lift oneself and those around you to a higher plane of enlightenment, to do what you can, in Jefferson's words, to ameliorate the condition of mankind. A meal is always infinitely more interesting to me before I eat it than after, when I'm always a little sheepish for making such a fuss about it or spending that much money to stoke the engine. I've made a lifelong study of Henry David Thoreau. You should come on the Winter Humanities Retreat west of Missoula. And he teaches that a kind of deliberate simplicity is what we need, what he calls voluntary poverty, the key to human happiness. I'd rather take a special date to the top of a butte than to the best restaurant in Paris with a baguette, a bit of very sharp and aged cheddar cheese, several squares of fine chocolate, and a flask of vin ordinaire, or as Edward Fitzgerald put it in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, a book of verses underneath the bough, a jug of wine, a loaf of bread, and thou, beside me, singing in the wilderness, O wilderness, were paradise enough. Yes, Jefferson may have been a foodie, in some sense of that term, but a whole mythology has sprung up around him that we know is exaggerated even when we trot it out in the usual way. That he brought ice cream to the United States, that he introduced macaroni and cheese, that he was a vegetarian, that he brought to America the first waffle irons, that he served a kind of baked Alaska in the White House. For all of these, yes, and partly no. Jefferson did say, no man ever regretted having eaten too little, which turns out to be true. He took great pride on meals he served at Monticello, his Virginia plantation home, and those he served in the White House, where he used food as a way of softening the tensions inherent in the political arena. Both Jefferson and Thoreau were known to eat very sparely. One observer said there was not an ounce of extra flesh on Jefferson. They were among the greatest thinkers in American history, the most creative minds we have produced. It was Thoreau's view, certainly, that the more we stuff into our mouths, the more we actually clog our souls. You don't want to try to write poetry after Thanksgiving dinner any more than you would want to perform in ballet. Since obesity is now the number one killer of Americans, and think of that, we all might wish to reduce and simplify our gastronomical intakes. If I had any moral courage, I'd be a vegetarian. One of the best people I know decided many years ago never to eat anything that once had a face. I've toured a couple of slaughterhouses, and I know how America's chickens are raised, and with what additives, and I know how hog confinement works. From a certain point of view, no rational being would ever eat meat again unless we raised and butchered it ourselves, which I have also done once or twice. What's worse than a food snob? Well, a craft beer snob. But that's not my point. What's worse than a food snob? A reverse food snob. And that may be the rhetorical reduction of this week's Jefferson Watch. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.